Blog Talk Radio.
My name is Mitch Mallett. Welcome to It's Your Gavel. And we have Jeff Ornstein, Dr. Jeff Ornstein, in the studio here with us. And he wrote a book, Fixing American Government. Now, I see we have a few callers already waiting. We're going to ask you just to hang in there for about 10 minutes so we can get the momentum going here, and then we'll open it up to some questions. And Dr. Ornstein, is that how you like to be referred to, or?
You can just call me Jeff.
Just call you Jeff? All right, very good. Well, you wrote this book, Fixing American Government. Why don't you talk to me about this book?
Okay. First of all, I guess I ought to tell people that I'm not just some bozo that just got off the turnip truck. I have a PhD in political science, and I taught at Kent State University for 25 years, and this is my seventh book on government and public policy. So I'm pretty serious about this. years and years and years, I've been teaching American government, basic American government courses to freshmen at the university before I retired and came to Florida. And I was frustrated by their lack of basic civic understanding of how our government works and how it compares to other kinds of governments out there. So, and since I now publish a magazine called Living on the Sun Coast Magazine in Sarasota, I took it as an opportunity to start writing some editorials about fixing American government. Pretty soon before I realized it, I had 19 of them, and people were emailing me and calling me and saying, you know, I love your essays. Why don't you write a book about it? And I said, well, okay, I've already got 19 chapters. So I sat down and I totally revised it and I organized it and I made it into 21 chapters. And I got a professional editor by the name of Veronica Belmont, who's really very, very good. And after working on it for a year, I wrote this book. And the thesis is pretty simple. It is that most of the problems in this country are due to an unfinished democratic revolution. We started out with having only white propertied males being able to vote for the House of Representatives and state legislators.
We didn't pick the Senate. We didn't vote for the Senate.
No, we didn't vote for the Senate. And what's happened in the intervening years is we have become a semi-democratic country. We now vote for the Senate directly, although it's very terribly malapportioned. There's two senators from Wyoming with a population of 583,000.
Is that the least populated state?
Yes, it is. And there are 38 million Californians, and they both have two senators. So if you are a Californian, you have 1/65th of the representation in the Senate than you do if you live in Wyoming. And if you're a Floridian, you have 1/32nd of the representation of Congress.
In the Senate,
yeah. Because everybody has one member of the House of Representatives, so everybody has the same amount of representation.
Well, in Wyoming, they have less people than we do in Manatee and Sarasota counties combined.
Yeah, they do. I don't know if you've ever been to Wyoming.
I have been to Wyoming.
So have I.
I've skied there in Jackson Hole.
It's a pretty state, but it's...
It's beautiful. There's more buffalo, I think, than people.
Yeah, I agree.
But anyway, so we got that. I don't know if that's the biggest issue. We've kind of, as a society, we've kind of learned to live with that. We got every state has two representatives in the Senate, but in the House, I think the biggest issue what I read in your book is the gerrymandering.
Oh yeah. For example, in Florida, we have approximately 52% of the people who are either registered as Democrats as opposed to registered as Republicans, and yet we have a heavily Republican state legislature because of gerrymandering. Basically, the people who get in power fix the districts so they continue to perpetuate their power. And interestingly enough, the Electoral College is... designed to mirror those districts, so it has national implications as well as local implications. And the state legislatures also draw our congressional seats. So although we have 435 members of the U.S. House of Representatives, there is not an equal apportionment.
Let's go into gerrymandering for a minute.
Okay.
I know what it is, and you certainly know what it is. But let's assume somebody listening here doesn't really understand.
It came from the colonial era and the colony of Massachusetts. There was a governor called Eldridge Gerry, G-E-R-R-Y, and he created a district that people said looked like a salamander. It picked up people who were favorable to him and avoided neighborhoods and areas that were unfavorable to him. And that's how the term gerrymandering started.
So we used to elect our governors before the American Revolution?
They were colonial governors. This is right after.
Right.
This is during the Articles of Confederation period, if I remember. I'm not a historian,
okay.
But
this is before 1776 and 1787.
It was just around that period, between 1776 and 1789, when the Constitution was ratified.
So this is when we were first electing our state reps and our governors, and
right.
And it didn't take long for somebody to figure this out, did it?
No, didn't take long at all. Gerrymandering is a problem, and it is theoretically outlawed both under, since we're here in Florida, we can talk about the Florida Constitution. It's outlawed under the Florida Constitution, and in principle, it's outlawed by the Voting Rights Act. That's 50 years old this year, but in fact, and in practice, it's widespread. It's almost everywhere.
Well, when the Voting Rights Act was first implemented, it kind of went away for a while, and it's just encroached, where it seems like every couple election cycles, it just gets more and more bold, where now it's as bold as can be.
Yeah, and
let me describe what it is in more detail. What it means is you live in an area, and you want to cut up the area, you'll take an area and you'll go, all right, there's a metropolitan area here surrounded by more rural areas. But the metropolitan area, and this is true in the capital of Texas, where it's very Democratic capital. So what they've done is, so they don't get any representation from Congress, because that capital should be represented, in theory, by a Democratic congressman. So what they've done is, all right, we're going to take a little bit of this district and spread it out amongst all these surrounding Republican districts, so it dilutes the Democratic vote, and there is no Democratic congressman elected in that area. Right here in Manatee County, before they redistricted, when it used to be called the 13th Congressional District, Hillsborough County is a very Democratic area. And they went down and they scooped out, this is in 2001, the legislature scooped out a good section of Palmetto and downtown Bradenton and gave it to Hillsborough County because, all right, Hillsborough County is going to go Democratic anyway. Let's suck all these Democrats up into their district. Now, in
thereby ensuring that the district to the south in Manatee County and Sarasota County was more likely to be in the hands of a Republican.
Right, and in 2002, it was Jan Schneider ran against Catherine Harris, and it was almost 48, 52, 53% spread. But had the same people who voted in Manatee County that were given to Hillsborough County voted for Jan Schneider, Jan Schneider would have narrowly won that race.
And Christine Jennings would have beaten Byrne Buchanan, too.
Right, because that was down to a few hundred votes.
Yes, 343, if I remember.
Right. So it changes election results.
Yep, well, that's what it's designed to do. The party in power uses their ability to draw the districts to make sure that they stay in power. It's not only, in the last 20 or 30 years, the Republicans have dominated our state legislatures in this country, so Democrats are saying, see, the Republicans do it, but I got news for you. They all do it. When the Democrats are in power, they gerrymander too. Gerrymandering is wrong no matter who does it, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat or independent. If you're serious about democracy and one person, one vote, having districts that overrepresent one side and underrepresent the other side structurally just don't make any sense. And that's one of the things that we need to fix in this political system. There are others, by the way.
Absolutely. You wrote about it in your book. You talked about how it's changed, like, for instance, the Republican Party, where it's a rock-solid Republican district where it'd be like the guy would have to be caught with a murder weapon, freshly murdered somebody a couple weeks before the election to lose the election. Rock solid. And how has that changed the Republican Party?
But what it meant, what it means is that because you have a safe seat, the real fights are within the primaries of the Republican Party, because the person who wins the primary is generally considered to be a lock on winning the general election. So it's divided the party. You have the right wing versus a disappearing left wing of the Republican Party, and the right wing is threatening the so-called middle of the road of the Republican Party with dumping them in a primary, thereby forcing members of Congress to pay more attention to the right wing, even though they're, by the best guesstimates of reputable public opinion polling, they're anywhere between 13 and 16% of the country in terms of solid ultra-conservative Republican Tea Party ideals.
The Tea Party, where they disbelieve in global warming and how old is the Earth and immigration.
There are, well,
you know, a whole bunch of issues. So
there is no one single Tea Party, but there is a generally
there's a loosely formed movement.
Yeah, and they are, from my point of view as a political scientist, they have some rather dysfunctional and bizarre views. But that's my personal opinion. I happen to believe in science and public opinion polling and being accurate.
So they have a disproportionate sway in the people get elected.
Yes, they do.
Because you called the left wing of the Republican Party was gone in during Reagan, but there's a moderate wing, and then there's the radical right wing.
Yeah, when I grew up, liberal Republicans were not unheard of. Even a former congressman from this district, Dan Miller, is a pretty liberal Republican. Senator Jacob Javits from New York was an example of somebody.
These people were
social liberals who really did believe in equality. They were affiliated with the Republican Party for many reasons, and some of them had conservative fiscal positions. But those people are an endangered species now.
Well, there's a Democrat named George Wallace who was probably was fitting well with today's Tea Party.
Yes, he
said that there's not a dime's worth of difference between the two parties, referring to the late 60s.
Well, in the South, you had, before the Johnson era, you had a single-party system. That's an example, by the way, of Democratic gerrymandering as opposed to Republican gerrymandering. And the Southern Democrats were, or the so-called Dixiecrats, were as conservative as the, or more conservative than the liberal wing of the Republican Party at the time.
Exactly. And actually, when Johnson passed the civil rights legislation, he even publicly stated, we just lost the Democratic Party from the South.
Yep.
And that was the late 60s, and what did it take, about 12, 14 years till Reagan came around, and he just basically got a lot of Democrats to switch parties. They were Democrats for Reagan, and then they became Republicans, and a lot, even right here in Manatee County, a lot of the and I'm 58. You're probably about my age, and
then some,
and then some. You look good.
Thank you.
But the people who are my contemporaries who grew up here, I've been here about 18 years, but who grew up here, maybe older than me, in the 80s, they were all young Democrats. Now they're older Republicans that kind of run the Republican establishment here in Manatee County.
Well, there's a prominent developer in this town who was a state senator as a Democrat, and now he's head of the Christian Coalition and a strong supporter of the conservative wing of the Republican Party.
Yeah, Mr. Neal. With Pat Neal?
Yes, that's who I was referring to.
Yeah, well,
I once asked Pat, I said, why are you a Republican? He looked at me and he says, why are you a Democrat? Yeah. At the end of that conversation.
Yeah, he didn't want to get into it. He's a personable guy, but
yeah, he is. I like Pat. And by the way, a word about I am a Democrat, by the way, and people generally know me as somebody who supports Democratic candidates, but this is not a Democratic book. This is a nonpartisan book. This book is about the structure of American government, and both parties would, and as well as independents, would benefit from some of the reforms that I'm talking about, and everybody suffers from some of the non-democratic, small d democratic problems we have. When I say democratic, by the way, I make a distinction between large D, which is the Democratic Party of the United States, which is an organization, and small D, the political party, and a small d concept of democracy.
Yeah, I usually just call it democracy. It's easier in conversation.
But when I say I'm looking for a more democratic America, I am looking for an America which pays more attention and finishes its small d democracy revolution.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not necessarily advocating that we elect more people to the Democratic Party versus the Republican Party.
Well, I got that from your book. And right now, there's more abuses nationally from the Republican Party than there is from the Democratic Party. And both parties have a history of doing what they can. And that's really the
problem. The Republican Party is generally in power, except for the White House at the moment. So I don't think it's fair to say there's more abuses. Let's just say those who are in power tend to exercise their power to their own advantage. And if the Democrats took over the same system, large D Democrats in this case, I would suspect they would do the same thing, and I would still oppose it.
All right, what are your fixes?
Well, we haven't really gotten into the causes yet.
All right.
Okay.
Let's take a quick break, and we're going to get into the causes and the fixes in just a few minutes here.
Okay.
And we'll be right back after this.
Imagine a world where everyone can access an attorney about any legal issue. Now, imagine a world where everyone can afford it. Thanks to Legal Shield, that is the world we live in today. A world where one legal service company is helping millions of families live life on their own terms. So instead of worrying about all the things that can go wrong, for as little as $17 a month, they can get on with their lives, knowing legal advice is a phone call away. The service Legal Shield provides is one of a kind. Our unique network of dedicated law firms is the key to providing a high-quality customer experience. With a law firm in 49 states and 4 Canadian provinces, we have your legal needs covered wherever you may be. And because our law firms are prepaid, their focus is on serving you rather than billing you. From the trivial to the traumatic and everything in between, our attorneys are always there to not only give you legal advice, but also write letters and make phone calls on your behalf, prepare legal documentation such as wills and powers of attorney, and even represent you in court should you ever need it. Plus, with an extensive library of complimentary forms and information, you can download what you need when you need it. Imagine for one low monthly fee that you and your family can talk to an attorney about any legal issue without worrying about high hourly costs. Join Legal Shield today, and you can stop imagining and start living life in a whole new way, empowered, with complete confidence, and total peace of mind. Legal Shield. Worry less. Live more.
Legal Shield. Worry less, live more. I'm Mitch Mallett. Not only am I the host of the show, I'm an independent associate with Legal Shield. And you can reach me at 813-924-7994 or visit my website, Mallett Agency, MallettAgency.com. And you can go there and you can take a look at some of our other products besides our legal plans. We have commercial truck driving plans for commercial truck drivers, rather. And we also have business owner plans. If you have under 100 employees, we have plans for you. And we also have identity theft plans, which will, in combination with our membership, will dispute everything that's derogatory on your credit reports. So basically, we'll clean up your credit restore your identity, protect your identity, monitor your identity. And there's a little button there also that says sell Legal Shield. Check that out if you're looking for a part-time or full-time career. And we're back here in the studio with Dr. Jeffrey Ornstein. He just likes to be called Jeff. He wrote the book Fixin' American Government and Ending the Gridlock and Apathy with a 21st Century Constitution. And, Jeff, I think you want to go back and talk about the Founding Fathers for a minute?
Yeah, you know, it's conventional wisdom.
Let's hold your – pull that mic a little closer to you.
Okay. I don't think it's on.
Oh, you know, now it's on.
Okay. You know, it's conventional wisdom to say that today's crop of greedy and highly partisan politicians has caused gridlock. And if we'd elect better people, we'd have a better political system. And we'd get back to the American dream. But I'm suggesting in this book that maybe we are living the American dream, the dream of our founding fathers. It's the system itself that caused many of our problems. Let me give you a couple of brief definitions. I can't help being a college professor here. Let me define democracy first. Democracy is 3,000 years old. It's literally power of the people, self-rule. It can be direct, where we decide on referenda through a direct vote of the people, such as they do in Switzerland from time to time, or indirect. An indirect democracy or representative democracy is electing a group of people and holding them responsible to public opinion by the threat of throwing them out. Through something called a general election, something that is sadly lacking in this country. And when we talk about reforms, I'm definitely going to get there. I usually hear from some people that, wait a minute, this country is a republic, not a democracy. That's probably true. What's a republic? Well, I checked various definitions from reputable political scientists that I know and respect, and the consensus is that it's an obsolete term that simply means a non-monarchy. You can have the Republic of Korea, and you can have the Republic of Swaziland, and you can have the United States as a republic. It's not a meaningful term, is what I'm saying.
The Soviet Union called themselves a republic,
yeah,
didn't
they? It's not a terribly meaning term. With those definitions in mind, let's take a quick trip back in history to Philadelphia. And from May to September 1787, that's a mere 228 years ago, when the Founding Fathers met after the Articles of Confederation had failed.
That was our first attempt at a constitution.
Yes, and I say the Founding Fathers because there were no mothers invited. These were all comfortable elites. They were people who were in power. They'd just gone through two major events. They had suffered real colonial oppression from the British, who had a sadly out-of-touch monarchy, and they had just experienced a failed Articles of Confederation with not enough governmental authority.
Plus the American Revolutionary War was brutal on a lot of areas of the colonies.
Yeah, it was. And the founders embraced the prevailing world view of not trusting human nature. And they brought those experiences and their distrust of human nature to this convention. And they were led away from democracy, even though democracy was debated in the Constitutional Convention. It was not terribly popular and never got anywhere. And they moved away from democracy and created a deliberately complicated system of checks and balances and separation of powers that's designed so that nobody can really easily wrest control of it once they have control of it. And, in fact, when there are real conflicts and the country truly gridlocks, as happened in the 1860s, the government couldn't handle it, and it spilled out on the battlefield.
Right, the Civil War.
That's right.
Well, there's a built-in gridlock to our form of government.
And that leads to voter apathy. People don't vote because they don't think their vote counts. We don't have a general election in this country, and a general election is defined as the ability of a citizenry to go to the ballot box and either elect or unelect the government, change the government. It happens in Europe all the time. We don't have that because we elect the president every 4 years, except only two terms now. We elect the House of Representatives every 2 years, and we elect one-third of the Senate at a time every 2 years.
So 2 years. So they serve 6 years.
That's right. So they, we can never go and change it, and we never touch the those who have the power, what they call the power of judicial review, which is Supreme Court, nine people appointed for life, who can basically, they are a de facto legislature and a legislature of last resort. If they say something is unconstitutional, they can make it stick. They've done that since Marbury versus Madison in 1803.
Well, an example of that just recently is the Supreme Court, for at least three decades, we've kept having election reform laws with more and more controls on how much money flows into our election cycle, and the Supreme Court basically just threw that aside, didn't they?
They certainly did. Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission.
So now we can have one family pledge $900 million to $1 billion to flow into the 2016 election cycle.
Yep.
One family. That's more than the Republican Party was planning on raising.
I know who you mean.
Yeah. Brothers.
Yeah. The system they created was allowed white property males, and those are the only people who were enfranchised to vote. They allowed white property males to choose, and we're talking on the national government now, to choose their representatives from their district.
Congresspeople then at that time.
Right. The state legislature chose the Senate, appointed the Senate, and they voted for a committee called the Electoral College who would meet and decide who would be president. And there was never a presidential election at that particular time. Since then, the country has democratized substantially. We've enfranchised all people except for voter suppression laws out there. So,
in theory, anyone over the age of 18.
Right.
Children are still oppressed, but maybe that's appropriate, right?
I don't know if it's appropriate or not. I'll settle for 18.
18 is good because we don't want people having a lot of kids just so their kids can vote the way they're told.
All adults, male and female. And we now have direct election of the Senate, but of course it is a staggered election only a third of the time. And we still don't have direct election of the presidency. For example, three times in American history, the last time in 2000, somebody won the more votes in the election for president of the United States and the other person took office.
Right.
And of course that was George W. Bush. And it happened right here in Florida.
Right. He won the Electoral College, but did not win the popular
vote.
That's
right.
By what, about 600,000?
Yeah. Al Gore won more votes. There was never any question that Al Gore got more votes than George W. Bush for president of the United States.
Right. But there was a question whether he got more votes in Florida or not.
Yeah, I know, but I don't have the answer to that. I don't have a crystal ball. I have my suspicions, but I won't voice those in a public forum.
Well, all I can say is that it lends itself to abuse when Catherine Harris, our Secretary of State at the time, can stand up there and go, "It's within my discretion." Those are her words.
Yes, I remember.
To declare George Bush the winner right now.
I remember, but the real decision was made by the Supreme Court.
Right, because then it went to the Supreme Court.
Right.
And that was like a unanimous party split there, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. Right down the road.
Right.
But what's happened to the American nation in the last 220-some years? What's happened is, first of all, we're much more populated. There's much more at stake in government. We're far more educated, and we have the ability to disseminate information so that people can make intelligent choices on who governs them.
Right. There's another big variable there that's changed. Back then, a business person would own a business within their community or city or town. There weren't large conglomerates of businesses that dominated the landscape.
Right.
It was all basically local entrepreneurs. So now there's a concentration of power within corporations that didn't exist at the time of the founding fathers.
Yep. But the whole political and economic system has gotten vastly more complicated and much more at stake. But the interesting thing is, although we had a partial democratic revolution, in the sense that we enfranchised everybody, and we now directly elect the Senate, but although we still have the Electoral College, the system has largely remained unchanged. When you have divided government, and Americans seem to like divided government for some reason. I don't understand why they like it. But when you have divided government, you have gridlock. And when you have gridlock, you have inability of the government to respond to the issues of the day. And when the government can't respond to the issues of the day, people suffer. So what I am suggesting, now we can talk, you asked me about reforms. That's the nature of our problem. And what I am suggesting is to continue the evolution, and I'm not talking about revolution in any violent or running out in the street with guns sense, to continue the evolution of the American political system toward democracy. And there are a few things that are kind of low-range solutions we can do, and then there are high-range solutions that will require substantial changes of the Constitution. Now, I haven't taken leave of my senses, and I don't believe that suddenly we're going to abolish separation of powers and checks and balances. It's just not going to happen. But there are a lot of things we can do to make the political system more small-d democratic and more equitable.
And they are?
Okay. Number one.
And as you get started, I just want to share, I think all but one of your proposals are very realistic.
Well, thank you.
There's one of them out there. It's a lot out there, and we'll get that to the end.
All right. One of the things we need to do is create better citizens with better civic education. This country has not done a very good job in teaching civics and teaching knowledge of government. As somebody who taught government for 25 years at a professional level, I am...
And where did you teach?
Kent State University in Ohio.
What years did you teach?
I was there from 1970 to 95.
1970, that was an interesting year for Kent State.
Yes, May 4th, 1970 is when four students were killed on campus. I happen to have been in Madison, Wisconsin that day, defending my PhD dissertation. I was not present there.
But you were on the faculty at the time, but not...
Yeah. I'd been hired. I started teaching that September, and I...
That could be a conversation of another show, but we probably shouldn't get bogged down there.
Okay. So I would like to see us dramatically increase the level of civic education. I would like to not only make it required for a certificate at every level, and that includes... elementary school, middle school, high school, and college, but I would like to see far more qualified teachers. Rather than have people who are part-time civics teachers, I would require teachers who are certified to teach civics and government to have at least an undergraduate degree in political science and probably continuing education in order to maintain their certification, professional education in the field. I'd like to see them paid well. Because I don't think we pay teachers very much. And I'd also like our civics not to be just wave the flag and here's how our system works, but it to be comparative and analytical and thoughtful and compare our government to governments in Europe and Asia and the possibilities and really have a discussion of political values.
Like comparative religion, comparative government class?
That's right.
That's right. That's interesting. We have a caller. We have a... Lawrence from St. Petersburg. Go ahead, Lawrence.
Good morning. I was listening to your very interesting program, and as it were, I was at Kent State at that time and personal friends with one of the deceased.
Wow.
Sandy Scheuer.
All right. That's and, the name that we all remember.
Well, okay. Well, I'm sure Mitch didn't remember that, but you and I obviously did.
Well, you were on the campus. I was in high school.
Oh, okay. Well, I was there. Okay. So I'm just as a point of interest. I know how important it is to establish credibility. So I was there, and I just thought I would point that out.
That's something that university has never recovered from.
Well, I find it a very pleasant looking campus, and I think that notoriety has put a spotlight on Kent, and I think it's one of the many small universities in Ohio that are good examples of colleges.
I enjoyed my 25 years.
You get better off of it on your head. I don't know what's causing that.
So, are you? You're obviously. Where did you live in Ohio? Where are you from?
Well, I was born and raised in Cleveland, but I got my PhD from the University of Wisconsin in Madison.
Oh, okay. But what part of Cleveland? Because I am an Ohioan also.
I graduated from Cleveland Heights High School.
Okay.
All right, Lawrence?
Yes?
I want to thank you for the call. But
why are you cutting me off, Mitch?
Because we have 11 minutes left and there's more topic to go over.
Oh, okay. I just thought I would insert some relevance as he was talking about Ohio and
question?
Kent State.
Yep.
But I guess it's all about you, huh, Mitch?
No, it's about the book, Fixed an American Government.
How about Five Times in Israel? Go for that one.
All right. That's fine.
Okay. So one of my reforms is create better civic education so we can have a more informed citizenry who can handle increased democratization of the
political system. That includes some education reform.
Oh, yeah. No question about it. To employ and fairly pay teachers who are certified experts and who really teach civic education, not propaganda 101. The other thing I would like to do is empower voters. I would like to nationalize elections for national offices. I think the 50 states have done a terrible job in maintaining consistency and eligibility in elections. So I would like to see when we're voting for national offices, I would like to see one set of rules. I would like to see online registration and day of election registration. If you can do that with a bank, if the bank can, you can do online banking with your money.
India, whose landmass is almost as big as ours, who's got a population three times ours, on election day, you can go to any voting place, and with your voting card, it determines what your local, the computer determines what your local elections are. So you can go anywhere where it's convenient and then vote in. And it's nationally computerized. If India can pull that off.
Yeah, it's well within our capabilities. I would also like to see online voting, and I would like to see us hold elections over at least a three-day period, not just one day, but allow it over a weekend and a weekday, which most European political systems do.
I'd like to see a day off from one of those, at least one of those days. If you can't go to 3 days, it'd be a day off without sales, and because some of the voter oppression takes place where the employer will suddenly require overtime on election day and not let his workers home.
Another thing I would like to do is level the campaign playing field. I'd like to get money out of politics. I'd like to repeal the Citizens United decision. And enact real public financing of elections. Running for office is an act of patriotism, as far as I'm concerned. And it's just absurd that you have to spend most of your time begging for money. And if you do get money, the people who give you money are going to expect something in return for it.
Exactly. And actually now our Congress people will tell you they spend half their day not working on legislation, but raising money.
Yep.
On a daily basis.
It's absurd. And the people who run our radio and television stations in this country are using a precious public resource of the airwaves. It is a public utility. And as far as I'm concerned, rather than spending lots and lots of money buying commercials from them as a requirement for their licensure, I would like to see them give commercials give airtime to all candidates for public office. We've repealed the fairness doctrine and equal access. I think we need to bring that back. And we also need to do it like they do in England, where you have a minimum of 30 minutes. Because in 30 minutes, you have to actually say something. You can't just throw one-liners and cliches one after another.
Even our debates boil down to 30-second sound bites.
No, I know.
Rehearsed.
I was in England during a national election, and I was watching it on television at a colleague's house. And it was interesting, really fascinating. The level of debate was far more sophisticated than it is here. And they have a six-week campaign, and then they have a silent period after the campaign where people get to think about it before they go to vote. So I'd like to see us level the campaign playing field that way by getting money out of politics. I'd like to see us make elections much fairer. I'd like to enact a new Voting Rights Act, as I said, federalizing federal elections and creating equal districts by outlawing gerrymandering at the national level and, in fact, make it a crime punishable by prison. That might get somebody's attention. And also get rid of term limits. Because we have the ultimate term limit, and it's called vote no. The problem with term limits is as soon as we get somebody in there with any experience who's any good, they're term limited out, and the only people who have institutional memory and who understand the intricacies of public policy making in today's complex world are the staffs, and the staffs are not elected, but they stay on.
Now you're referring to the state level, but now the staffs are running many of the states.
I know they are, and we also have term limits in the presidential elections. In the aftermath of Roosevelt serving four terms, or being elected four times, he died during his fourth term, we enacted a limitation on two terms for the presidency.
Did that under Eisenhower. Republicans put that in there.
Immediately creating a lame duck president right after they're reelected, allowing people like Richard Nixon to put all kinds of money and stakes into the one reelection that they needed to accomplish. It's a bad, bad idea as far as I'm concerned. Imagine if Roosevelt had been restricted to two terms, just as World War II was heating up. We would have had to change leaders. That wouldn't necessarily have been a smart idea at the time. So I'd like to see us, now we can get into more radical kinds of things. They're not really radical, but I'd like to see us attack some of the issues that are caused by separation of powers and create real general elections, and that would require constitutional reform. I would like to put the House and Senate on equal terms, so we elect all of them at the same time. I'd like to see us double the size of the Senate and make it equally apportioned, too, instead of two senators from each state. So if there are 583,000 people from Wyoming, they get that percentage, that proportion of the representation.
We got about 2 minutes left here.
Okay. So what we need to do is change the conversation, Mitch. You know, to use an inelegant analogy,
I agree with everything but the Senate, and I have to kind of wrap my head further around that. And we have time left in the show to understand what you want to do with the Senate.
If I could wave my magic wand.
Let me do this. Let me tell people, again, the name of the book. The book is Fixing American Government. There's a website there. Guess what the name of it is? FixingAmericanGovernment.com. And there's a Facebook page that you blog on. You continually write.
Blog on the website.
Oh, you blog on the website.
FixingAmericanGovernment.com is the website, and Facebook.com/FixingAmericanGovernment is where we have a community. Right now there are 52 people there. I'd like to make it several more.
Well, I think after the show, I think you'll see it grow substantially over the next few days.
Good. That'd be great.
Is the book
available
on Amazon?
The book is available on Amazon. The book is available at BarnesandNoble.com. It's available at Kobo.com. It's an e-book version, and you can get a paperback version on Amazon. It's available.
All right. Well, with that all said, that's about all the time we have, and I want to thank you, and we're going to have you back.
My pleasure, Mitch.
All right. And let me just hit a little button here.
close out our...
Hello, brand new song.